Good morning. Anthea Butler in Philadelphia and Peter Larman here in Los Angeles. Say hello, Anthea.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
That's good.
I'm doing okay. Despite the slick and the drizzle here, we're going to be just fine.
Absolutely.
Now, we're going to have a review today of some phobias that are sweeping our country and causing a little bit of inanity here and there. And we're going to go deep on phobia a little bit. I mean, I think we ought to simply begin with a certain amount of sex panic about the Supreme Court nominee, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. What is it about a single woman that makes everybody panic? Nobody can figure out who she's having sex with. We got to figure out how we're going to match her up. It's ridiculous.
It is kind of ridiculous, but it really spiked, and I don't think for some it's gone away yet. Now, of course, they'll turn to her administration of the Harvard Law School, but I thought Maureen Dowd was hilarious in portraying Professor Kagan, Solicitor General Kagan, as a hot babe always on the prowl for hot men and someone who never watches Rachel Maddow under any circumstance.
Not at all. But, you know, what's fascinating to me is that all of these sorts of notions about single women or what women are doing are embedded in these kinds of, you know, crazy religious traditions, right? And we've got this, even the media has an underlying sense in which they decide how they're going to vet someone by whether they're married or not, what's their sexual orientation, and all of these things have a religious connotation. So where they try to pretend that, oh, we're not thinking about all these things, the reality is that they care. They want to get in bed with everybody. Why is it that we're in so many people's beds? Who cares? I don't want to be in a Supreme Court justice nominee's bed.
Yeah, maybe actually a way of dealing with this phobia and tamping it down a little bit would be to have what they called in the 18th century a panopticon for people who might ever serve in government, you know, sort of 24/7 spying from all angles. Don't you think that would work?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, this is actually, you know, sidebar, Philadelphia is the place where that panopticon happened with the Eastern prison over here. So that was like we could watch the prisoners and see what they're doing. So maybe we just need to put everybody in a cage before you can be nominated to the Supreme Court so we can watch you 24/7. They're like a reality show, right? I mean, I don't mean to be flip about this, but I do think there's a sense in which, I mean, nobody asked this about, you know, all the married men, except, you know, of course, with Clarence Thomas, there was a whole other thing that happened with him.
And
exactly. So his sexuality got put on trial in a whole different kind of way. But I do think it is, you know, slightly troubling to watch people like Family Research Council and others try to figure out, you know, is she gay, is she not gay, how's she going to be on these issues, and use that, you know, vet her on the basis of whether she's, you know, and has a partner or not.
Yes, and this will dare not speak its name in the hearings, but you can bet it'll be in the room.
Oh, you better believe it, and you better believe
you
it.
You almost wish that they would speak it openly.
Yeah,
you see what I mean? Because the absurdity of it would then come clear.
Exactly, exactly. And I think it's one of the things the American public needs to see. I mean, when we start asking these questions out loud, how does it really sound? How does it look? And I'm wondering, you know, in these private go around and meet sessions, it seems to me that the questions that will probably be asked privately will be those kinds of questions where people can get away with those kind of things. It's sort of like an employment interview, right? Do they have the same kind of rules that we would have if we were hiring an employee? I don't think so. I think anything's probably fair game in those private conversations, don't you think?
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got a little bit of similar sex panic in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, of all places, in regard to a dean for Marquette University. Our colleague, Mary Hunt, had a wonderful piece in Religion Dispatches this morning about the withdrawal of an offer. I think her name is O'Brien.
Exactly.
And interesting that the aging president of Marquette, I believe he would be a Jesuit priest, wouldn't he? I heard him on, happened to be in Wisconsin, and I heard him on television saying this has absolutely nothing to do with her sexuality or with academic freedom or with any pressure from the church hierarchy. So, of course, that left open the question of, so what is it again?
Yeah, exactly. A, what is it again? And B, are you going to pay me since you withdrew the offer? I mean, what I would love to know is if they already sent her out, that they sent her out an offer letter and then they withdrew the offer. That would be very interesting to know. But I think, you know, this panic, this withdrawing of the offer, I mean, everybody knew on the table what she had written. Everybody knew she was a lesbian. I mean, why is it okay to be a lesbian at one Jesuit institution and not be okay to be a lesbian at another Jesuit institution, right? Now, mm-hmm. you know, the question is for me is that, you know, where does Marquette see themselves? And are they saying we're to the right of Seattle or not? That's the first thing. And the second is, what does that mean for faculty there who are, you know, homosexual or lesbian? What does that mean for them? Because obviously this is giving a very big message to whoever's presently at Marquette, who is LGBT population. So I wonder about that, first of all. And then secondarily, I mean, you know, Jesuit institutions have to face a very big problem right now, which is how many Jesuits are you going to have to run these places? At the end of the day, you can't find people to be deans, let alone presidents. They're running out of people who are able to be, you know, to run the institutions per se. Georgetown is already headed by someone who's not a Jesuit. Loyola Marymount, where I used to teach, is, you know, just their president just stepped down. They're looking for a new president. Is that going to be a Jesuit priest or not? So I think this question is an even bigger question than just them, you know, doing this awful thing of rescinding an offer. It's about what is the future of these institutions when they don't even have the people in their own orders to run them, first of all. And then secondly, how do you have so much rampant homophobia? And, you know, some people are going to get upset with me about this, but duh. I mean, look around the average Catholic institution or order right now. Everybody's in the damn closet. So the question becomes, how are you going to deal with this in the future? And if they're going to go to the right this far, what does it mean in terms of the kinds of students that they are going to be able to attract, first of all? And second, what does it do to them in terms of accreditation?
Well, it's kind of tragic because Marquette is a great school and aspiring to still more greatness, and I think this is going to really throw them for a big loop. I'm just sorry to say that. Yeah. Let's zero in a little bit on phobia directed at oneself and the strange ways in which that works its way through. I'm doing a little review of the news here. What about that evangelist George Reckers? Is that not an outstanding case of somebody who is internally divided?
Well, it's definitely divided and definitely phobic about their own sexuality. I mean, come on now. I mean, who gets somebody to carry their luggage from rentboy.com, okay? I mean, I've had problems with luggage before, but, I mean, you get the $3 luggage cart, right?
And a lot cheaper.
Expensive. Right. But, you know, the thing is about this is the phobia. So, you know, Reckers, I mean, what's awful about Reckers is that he's saying, no, you know, pay me to tell you how come gay parents can't adopt kids in Florida. And he did the same thing, I believe, in Alabama. But
he's an expert.
Yeah, he's an expert, right? So he's an expert because he's fighting his own urges. So that's the first thing, okay? So if, like, he would say that up front, that would be okay. And the second thing is that why is it? I mean, we think about Reckers, Haggard, all of these people who are, you know, either a sort of, how should we put it, right-wing Christians, okay? But they're very much talking about, you know, how homosexuality is bad. And then, poof, all of a sudden, they're having to go pay for it. And they're going out to do these things. What does that say about the depth of the bifurcatedness of themselves and their own phobia against being able to be who they are? And it's just been funny to me. The jokes have been great, but what I think is a deeper sort of this sense of, it's almost like Du Bois' double consciousness in a way, but in a very different way. You know,
I thought about that in a different way, but there's something like that. And, you know, this is so old school. I had thought that, you know, this is a familiar pattern from the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I had thought that people were able to work their way through a middle path. And apparently that's not the case for these people who are so deep in their internalized closets.
Well, don't you think that the phobias, though, are really like 50s and 60s sexual phobias? I mean, I'm surprised that Records didn't decide to sign himself up for one of these places where he could get, you know, get cured of his homosexuality. Or, you know, I could even see him, you know, submitting to shock therapy or something.
That might be next.
Yeah,
that
I mean, maybe the next thing for him to do. I mean, that's the same thing they did with Haggard. It's like, you know, go and do these other things. But what I find is interesting, the difference between Haggard and Records is that Haggard says I'm not gay, but I'm not sure where I am. He's in a different kind of nebulous place. And I think that's very interesting in the way he talks about his sexuality vis-a-vis right. somebody like a Records who says, I am not this. But the bigger implication is this. I'm wondering if, and you might want to say something about this, if all of these communities are sort of locked in to this mindset about what 50 sexuality is like, and they're living in the 21st century. In other words, everything is based on, you know, the happy marriage, all of these things. But how is it that somebody like Records could walk around, go get Rent Boy, and nobody's asking him like they're asking Elena Kagan, why aren't you married? You know? This is a question
for me. Oh, well, now you're touching on something that a great gulf fixed in terms of expectations and standards.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Yeah. I mean, this is a thing. I mean, why not ask Records? Why don't you have a wife? Where's your wife? You know? I mean.
Well, he's too busy doing the Lord's work.
Yeah, he's too busy doing some heavy lifting, I think.
let's change it up a little bit. We'll get into some of the still more ominous phobias. I mentioned I was in Wisconsin, and I actually grew up in a hamlet full of Dutch Calvinists called Oostburg, Wisconsin, in Sheboygan County.
Oh my gosh!
Not terribly surprising to me, but horribly surprising to the people involved. There's a school outside of this village that used to be called the Harmony School. It was a one-room schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. The irony of the name Harmony apparently lost on everyone. Anyway, it was purchased by a Muslim. With the intention of creating a worshiping space. Muslims mm-hmm. in eastern Wisconsin now have a choice of driving 150 miles in either direction to worship. When this became known to the pastors in my hometown, they went nuts. They went completely nuts. And it's a huge news in the Midwest, all over the Midwest, that they're trying to block these people from purchasing this property. And the kinds of things that are said, the kinds of things that are said about, well, they'll bring arms to their worship service. We couldn't have that. They have multiple wives. I heard that from a neighbor of my mother's. But also that, you know, these people are essentially fascists, right? And the dominies.
Sounds like the Tea Party to me.
The dominies have to import experts on Islamofascism to keep these flames going. What the heck? I mean, I actually had to have a conversation with a couple of my mom's friends and neighbors to say they don't have multiple wives.
Yeah.
Right? These people are, after all, living in eastern Wisconsin. They're mostly doctors, you know, doctors, dentists, attorneys, not exactly people who just, you know, dropped in from Pashtun. But it seems to be not amenable to reasonable argument.
No. You know, it's the kind of fear-based phobia. I mean, this is sort of I'm sure everybody out here is going to say you're blaming Bush again, but this is the holdover from the last, you know, the previous administration, I think, in part. Now, you know, I was born in a state where it's okay for you to carry a concealed weapon and take your gun into church, okay? I'm from Texas.
If you're a white Christian.
Yeah, so if you're Christian. A white Christian or a black Christian.
Well, white Christian. How about a white
Christian? A white Christian even. I don't even think they want black Christians taking guns into church.
Yeah,
it happens,
okay?
But it's the kind of craziness that happens when you have another kind of a group that's not your own group, white Anglo-Saxon, you know, good Christian Protestant, you know, quote unquote, coming in, and it's A, ridiculous, because half these people know already that if you're Muslim in this country, you're already probably under some kind of scrutiny one way or other. So what makes them think they're going to bring guns in, first of all? It's ridiculous. And then secondly, the issue becomes, if anybody else had come in, would they do this if it was a, you know, an African-American group buying it for a Baptist church, or let's say Nation of Islam or something, I imagine it would be the same kinds of things. But what's more troubling about this, I think, is that the kinds of things that are imposed upon this group. And everything you just said to me sounds like the same stuff Tea Party people have been doing. Or, you know, you think about that right-wing Christian group that just got arrested, the Hutari, about a month and a half ago in Michigan.
Right.
These are the same things that militia groups have been doing. So why is it all of a sudden it's upsetting that it's somebody who's coming in so that we can have a mosque and a place to worship so we don't have to drive an hour and a half away? So what's interesting to me about the phobias, and I want to hear what you have to say about this. What's interesting about the phobias is that every time the same kind of standard is not placed on somebody who's white. Anybody, a person of color, gets all these sorts of things put on them. But when it's somebody white doing these exact same things, you know, carrying guns, speaking out fast, you know, doing fascist statements about how, you know, the government's bad and all this other stuff, it's some kind of thing that the phobia gets shifted onto anybody who has some melanin in their skin. And this can't possibly be about anybody white. So it's two
things. Is this about the possibly about the tipping point that is approaching? I mean, in California, obviously, for a long time, the vast majority of people arriving here, people being born here, are people of color. That hasn't happened in the core of the Midwest. It's so interesting to me that Eastern Wisconsin, which when I was a kid there, was pretty much lily white. I mean, I didn't. You know, you had to go to Chicago, really, to find significant numbers of people of color. Sheboygan County even has lots of people from Mexico, Hmong, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think people, you know, people are the white people are polite in a kind of thin-lipped way.
Yeah, yeah.
Toward these people they consider to be newcomers.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really accepted, deep down, they're not accepted as entitled to be there.
No. And the other part about it is that it's as though everybody woke up and they had this, you know, profound sense of, oh my God, we're being taken over, right? When people like this have sort of been around for years, you know, they may have been a trickle at first. But now as the population has increased and, let's say, economic problems have ensued and people have lost their jobs, you have to look for the scapegoat, right? And in some kind of way, these are the people who are doing it. So whether their religion is different, their skin color is different, they wear some different clothes, all of a sudden these, you know, the dominant ranks close, you know, and I mean dominant not in numbers, but in thinking, right? Because
right, in the old hierarchical sense of
I mean, it's the exact problem we've had from the moment that, you know, President Obama took office. And people are going to say, you're saying this because you're a black person. I'm like, no, I'm not. It could have been, you know, a Latino. It could have been an Asian. Everybody, all the rest of the people would have the same response, which is, oh, my God, my people are now on the bottom of the totem pole. And so I'm wondering if your folks, the folks in Sheboygan, are sort of thinking, this is, you know, this is our last stand. This is the last hurrah because the world is changing. And the world around us, we can see those changes on television. But once it happens in your neighborhood, you know, it's not so Sesame Street anymore. It's not Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, right? It's some other kind of thing.
That was cool.
Was
cool.
Exactly.
But actually having to encounter people in the public square is not so cool.
Well, yeah, and I kind of wonder, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit because this is the area of the country you're from. I've been with all of these phobias. What I've really gotten a sense of when I listen and I've been watching people and reading a lot of these blog posts talking about these things, is that a sense of normalized Christianity, in other words, do unto others that you would have them do unto you, the golden rule, you know, all of this kind of things. It's not there anymore. The Christianity has become distorted in such a way that where you look at these good church-going people who would normally, you know, maybe say even 20 years ago, would have been, you know, very cordial to these folks and said, you know, let's be welcoming to the stranger in our midst, all these things. Now it's become a hard line, and it can't happen anymore.
Well, I actually talked to some clergy there, including my mother's minister, and said, so are there any good actors in this, religious good actors, who are raising the right questions? And apparently it's at the level of internal discussions, but the inclusive religious leaders haven't gone public with that message. If you don't go public with it, you might as well not even have the conversation internally.
Do you think that's about fear for them?
You've got to step out on that.
Do you think it's about fear?
Well, I think they're worried that they've got people in their congregations who probably agree with the you know, the hard line.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how that goes, right?
Yeah, exactly. You got to have the
This is a delicate subject.
Yeah, very delicate.
Let's wait for it to go away, and then we'll take a position.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, definitely. But it saddens me, though. You know, I keep thinking, you know, if nothing else, everybody could rally around in Wisconsin as, you know, the cheeseheads and be for the Green Bay Packers. But I suppose, and this is probably worth mention, maybe what the group that's trying to buy this Harmony Church should do is to allow the new Miss USA to come, who is a Muslima.
Right.
And maybe that would help out. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, of course, they're already looking at her because, you know, like, oh, we got to find out these stripper pictures, all this other stuff. I just went, here we go. It's the same thing that happened with Vanessa Williams, right? When you get the first one, we got to find something wrong, right? So, I mean, she hasn't even been able to enjoy 2 days of being Miss USA, where it's already, oh, she must have some pictures out there or something, right?
She's getting the treatment.
Yeah, she's getting the treatment. But I think she should come and open the mosque. That's what I think should happen.
Great.
I think she should come and open a mosque.
Yeah, of course, you know, I have to say this. You know, my kind of Dutch people, they probably think she'd be too scantily clad to introduce a whole... you know, no sex, please. We're Christians. That's their variety.
Well, yeah. But you know, everybody sort of, you know, they just wouldn't want her to do the bathing suit part of the contest. They want her to do the formal, you know, very nice evening gown thing.
Gotcha. I want to shift us again. And by the way, I want to get back in a little bit to the economics of fear.
Yeah.
Because we need to talk about that. I mean, you know, the reality is that for 20 years. The economic prospects for white males in the United States have been absolutely plummeting,
mm-hmm.
mainly with the decline of manufacturing. And I have a hunch that that lurks somewhere in the background here. But before we get to that, you wrote a splendid article, for Religion Dispatches, earlier this month on Arizona as the New Alabama. I can't quite recall the title, but... I wonder, Professor Butler, if we could talk a little bit about the latest twists and turns in Arizona in respect to people of Mexican origin. There seems to be no end to that.
Yeah, no, there is no end to it, and it's going to be a hard story before it gets better. So let me talk about that. I think what is the most underreported story, but I think is an important story, which is the role of one of the state representatives, Steve Montenegro. Now, what's interesting about this is that Montenegro is part of a church called Apostolic Assembly, and that is a Oneness Pentecostal denomination. There are probably about maybe 1,000 congregations in the U.S., maybe a very small number of people. I mean, I'd say less than 150,000. But
say the name of it again.
Apostolic Assembly. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Montenegro was one of the signers of HB 1070, which is the immigration law. He was also the sponsor of the bill that just got signed about not teaching these ethnic things in the schools. And I'm going to paraphrase him where he says, you know, they're teaching victimology when they're teaching about Chicano studies and things in the classroom. And so we don't want our students to learn about victimology through ethnicity. We want them to learn about other things. Now, here's the kicker. What's interesting to me about Montenegro is that he's also a national leader within the Apostolic Assembly. He is the vice president of their youth group, and he's also an assistant pastor at his father's church, Sunrise Assembly. Now, here's the thing. Montenegro's family came from El Salvador, and if you put this story together with the asylum story back in the 80s, and I think this is interesting to bring up because lots of people have not paid attention to the fact that the asylum issue in the 80s that happened was because Ronald Reagan said we're going to offer this and all this. There were problems with this, but a lot of people within churches, including Apostolic Assembly, got their citizenship. Steve Montenegro's family got their citizenship by saying by having people from Apostolic Assembly sign for them. And not only that, they said that they were persecuted. They came from El Salvador. Now here we are, you know, 20 years and change later, Montenegro saying, I don't want to have, you know, any kind of amnesty or anything for people who are here. When half of that, a good number of Apostolic Assembly people are people who crossed over the border. Some of them now are legal. Some of them now are not. Yeah,
his own people.
His own people who he's taken tithes and offerings from. So I think he's a very interesting figure in terms of looking at how this is going to play out in religious groups, because this will divide a lot of people, Pentecostals, Catholics, whole bunch of other folks. And this is a story that I don't think is being picked up in the regular kind of press. And Montenegro's place in this is, you know, as one church person put it to me, he's like Haman. He's ready to sell his people off, right? But I think it poses a lot of questions for, you know, not just the denomination, but for how other church groups will decide to deal with people who are within their ranks, who think about this immigration law as a good thing.
We have that generationally a little bit in California, mm-hmm. where a fairly significant number of multi-generation families whose origins are in Mexico or elsewhere in Central and South America are pretty tough on the newcomers. It's almost like we don't want to have our image dragged down,
yeah,
something like that.
Exactly. But I think, you know, in terms of thinking about this from the religious standpoint, it's not just an image thing. It's all about what are the benefits that have been afforded to us that we don't want to give to somebody else. Yeah. Who's come through the door. So, you know, I'd be interested to hear you think about this in terms of, you know, there's obviously a liberal stance to this, right, which is this law is wrong. It's wrong to say ethnic studies shouldn't be taught in the schools. It's wrong to say that we won't allow, we're going to racially profile people, which has been one of the things that everybody's worried about. But I wonder how we might want to think about this in terms of groups that don't pan out so clearly. And I'm thinking about Pentecostals and others here, mm-hmm. who you might find people on both sides of this issue. You know, what do you think is going to happen here? I mean, do you want to speculate?
Well, in as much as Pentecostalism seeks in all ways to be led by God's Spirit, my hope, and I'm not being, yeah. you know, frivolous in saying this, my hope is that the Spirit will speak and that people will understand that in God's eyes, people aspire to a better life, and nobody is illegal, right? And the story of God's people is always a story of migrants. I hope it breaks that way. I really no way of knowing. I mean, the problem is that people get also trapped in this frame of a scarcity narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a different kind of religious narrative than the abundant table narrative, for sure.
That's true.
It's still religious.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering too what this will mean on a, you know, broader level. I mean, obviously, Sojourners has a way of looking at this, and other groups, and I'm thinking about the National Hispanic Leadership Coalition and others.
Right.
But the way that this pans out, and one of the things I talked about in my article, is that they're not paying attention to the fact that, you know, this will have some polarizing effects. It's also going to have effects on the economics of the state, right? I mean, how do you expect that things are going to happen, or the people who are there maybe illegally, they don't feel comfortable about coming out anymore. They're not going to feel comfortable mm-hmm. about going to their jobs. They're not going to feel comfortable about anything, and they're going to leave the state of Arizona. And what do you do if you are a church person there and you've got people who are in your congregation who are both for and against this? I see this as being something that's going to be very divisive in the months to come. And evangelicals and others are not on the same page with this. And so I think we're going to see a split in a lot of religious groups because of this issue of immigration.
Right. And I said earlier that there's an economic driver under this for white males in the United States, but really there's an economic driver for all this stuff. I was intrigued by a study that came out last week. I think Paul Krugman cited it over the weekend in one of his columns, or maybe Monday, about the way in which economic anxieties, almost without exception worldwide, drive people to the right these days and
yes.
not to the left.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I always say that people aren't going to migrate left in the absence of articulation and popular education. But what do you think about that? I mean, do you see that pattern yourself? And do you see it playing, for example, in these religious currents about immigration and other issues.
Yeah, I do. But part of it is about, I think it's an issue for people who feel like things are out of control. I mean, if you're
it is about that.
Yeah, yep. It's about issue of control. Stability. And so if you move to the right, it's about things will get into place. We can get things lined up. We can, you know, we can stop fiscal, you know, this overspending. We can stop this. We can stop that. But the reality of it is that, you know, things move on a fulcrum, right, or this sort of pendulum, and they're going to move back and forth. So if you take the tack that moving, you know, everything is moving to the right, something is going to tip this back to the other side or tip it back to the middle. And I think we're entering into this time where it may look like for, especially here, in, you know, politically in the U.S., it may look like for a time that this sort of right thinking is winning. But the problem is going to become that, you know, if you move too far to the right, it's fascist, it's untenable. And then the question becomes is how long can you hold this, and how long will the power structure hold it? And I just see too much, there's too much fracturing going on for any of these coalitions to really hold any length of time. I mean, look at, and I'll give a good example. I mean, not that this has anything to do, well, that had a lot to do with us in a certain way, but not a lot to do with religion. If you look at what happened just in the UK elections a couple of weeks ago, this whole issue of not being able to, you know, how you're going to have to put together a coalition, these coalitions don't work. You can't get a majority if things are moving so far to the right that there's no room for consensus. So if you've got real hardliners, you can't move forward. And so I'll be interested. We're doing this today as, you know, right here in Pennsylvania, we're having an election day.
Oh, yes, you are.
So, Sestak and what's his name? So it's Spector. So what's going to happen here? How will these things play out in these sort of regional elections as we go forward to the midterms in November of 2010? I think what we're going to see is a move to the right, but will that move to the right hold? I don't think it will. I mean, I'm willing to put some money down on this right now and say it's only for a season. It's not for, it's not going to be for any extended length of time.
My dear, I'm going to have to bet against you on this, because if you push things all the way to the right, mm-hmm. I mean, I've said for a long time, and I'm not alone in saying this, I actually think it'll never be called fascism, of course, but I think we're in a position where the threat of what in essence is an American mm-hmm. fascism is quite real, quite potentially imminent. I mean, you have this odd phenomenon in the United States where we have a right populism, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, we've got all this stuff about the bank bailouts and all this distress about taxes, but it's working, it's manipulated by and working for the right. It's a very peculiar kind of puppetry mm-hmm. that you see going on here.
Now, I'd agree with you on that.
That and, you know, the anxiety, the perpetual anxiety about the future of whiteness in the United States of America. We've got a lot of ghosts here that haunt and torment us. I'm a little fearful about the pendulum business. I mean, mm-hmm. at a certain point, the pendulum stops swinging.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, or else it breaks. Right?
Yeah,
it breaks.
You know, and I realize that many, many calming people say, you know, look, we don't have anything like the economic distress that the Germans faced in 1929, 1930. It's not like that here. But I'll tell you, the festering discontent at people whose livelihoods are you know, measurably worse, right? And I was fascinated. I don't know if I'll write this or not, but I'm really fascinated by the fact that it now appears that the little green shoots of growth that we've seen in the economy over the last few months have all to do with the very wealthy spending and with people who hold mortgages that are underwater stopping paying their mortgages, and so they're back in the malls using money that they no longer give to their bank. Well, that's
exactly.
Obviously not sustainable.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's not, you know, it's, we laugh, disappearance, it really is the disappearance of a stable middle class in the United States has terrible, terrible auspices for our form of government. I just worry about that. And
I agree with you. But the point is, and this is what I think is the interesting piece, I mean, and you are free to, you know, disagree with me. I think you need a leader. if you're going to be fascist, you need a good fascist leader. And I'm sorry, Sarah Palin ain't in.
She's not it.
The question becomes is if you get somebody that's strong enough, who, you know, then it means real trouble. But right now I see it as, you know, these pockets of discontent, but with no person to lead them forward. Now, if you subscribe to, yeah, I need a leader, this is a populist movement, you know, it lasts for some time, but it needs a coalescing force. And right now it doesn't have a coalescing force. Doesn't have somebody who can bring all these factions together in certain kinds of ways. They can't bring the independents, the Tea Partiers, all these people who have this level of discontent. I mean, the only person right now, unfortunately, I think who could probably do it, but he'll never run for office because he's too busy spending his money, is Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. And you know, he does it in a terms of a, I don't want to put it, in a way that's a media savvy way, right? But it's not, there's no political leadership because most of these guys are either walking the Appalachian Trail or doing something else, right? So who's it going to be? And that's my bigger question about this not being able to hold is who leads it? Because you need somebody. I mean, everybody could get behind George Bush if you're worried about whiteness because, you know, there was George and he allowed, you know, certain minorities like Condoleezza Rice and others because they fit into this mold of, you know, this is the good minority person, right? They act like white people. But there's nobody around right now, you know, on any of these sides who I think even wants to court anybody of ethnicity. I mean, they can't even figure out how to make a coalition that'll hold together. You know, some of these disgruntled, I mean, how many is it today that's running? Maybe 36 black Republicans, somebody, you know, running for office. They can't even hold the people of color together in their groups. So how are they going to hold the whole, you know, the whole thing together?
Well, you don't necessarily do all of this electorally. I mean, that's true that the Germans voted for Hitler. But if you've got, you think about the degree of proto-fascism in the U.S. military, the extent of that, and then the sort of the part of the national security world that is completely out of sight, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are ways to do this. I agree with you that at the moment there's no obvious leadership for this, but it doesn't make me sleep any better.
No.
By the way, wasn't Lou Dobbs going to make some kind of move in this direction?
Oh yeah, I don't know what happened to him. I think he's off spending his money somewhere. Maybe he's gearing up for some election race. I mean, he used to be this great populist voice, but now he's sort of been replaced by Glenn Beck, you know, and Glenn Beck has the cry on cue thing going real well. So, and by the way, Glenn Beck just got an honorary degree. You know, from Liberty University.
Oh, Liberty, yeah.
Yes, so now it's Dr. Glenn Beck, so we're going to have to call him doctor the next time we see him.
I'll be sure to do that. let me take us in the direction of another fear factor that, in fact, could be part of an eventual trigger for an American fascism, and that, of course, is the threat of a major terrorist event on U.S. soil.
Yeah,
we can visit terrorist events on other people's soil, but it should never happen to us. Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And you know, the Miracle-Gro bomber in Times Square has elicited all this interest. You know, initially there was a deep sigh of relief, but now this, oh my God, these guys turn so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem?
Yeah,
here these guys, you know, living in a nice house in the suburbs, and he's
got everything.
He's got a great job. He's got a wife and kids, and you know, in 5 minutes he's back in Pakistan, and then he's planting a bomb in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
I was, it's reasonable to worry about that, obviously. But then we had the Attorney General saying you don't have to Mirandize people if you think they've done a real bad thing, which was kind of interesting because actually you don't have to Mirandize them anyway under current law. Get the information from them, but I underneath this, we get back to the myth of American innocence, right?
Yeah.
Why would anybody be surprised that the real threat of a real serious incident to the United States has increased since we've stepped up our activity, particularly our drone attacks in AFPAC, as it's called.
Yeah, right.
Why would anybody be surprised by that?
Well, I think people are surprised in part because they're not paying attention to what's going on. in Afghanistan or anywhere else. I mean, this is sort of like the
because Obama's president, right? Yeah, so it can't be so bad.
Yeah, well, no, it's not Obama's president. It can't be so bad. It's like Obama's president, and it's really bad back here at home. So we don't even have time to think. You know, we only have time to give placate the troops and like we love the troops, right? You know, if you think like you're on the right, you're going to say, you know, we love the troops. We think about what they're doing. They're in harm's way every day, but it's platitudes. It's not a real engagement with the war. And on the left, it's like, oh, you know, this war, we shouldn't be there in the first place, but we got to think about this other stuff. So nobody's paying attention to the fact that the things that we're doing overseas are going to make things increase at home. That's number one. But number two is, I want to throw another monkey wrench in here. I mean, it was interesting to me that we have people who are just homegrown terrorists. I mean, we've got two things that we have to hold in tension here in this country. One is that, you know, you may have people of foreign descent who decide, you know, my life's not good enough, I need to go back to Pakistan or wherever it is and train, or I want to come here and do something. And then we got our folks at home who are disgruntled, who are American-born, you know, got their papers and everything else, right? And who want to bomb stuff here, too, because they're sick of the way the government is running right now. So we've got two problems, and both of those problems are encroaching in to create some very troubling bookends, I think. So I don't think we could even just look at this as in terms of, you know, Americans, say, wanting to go and join Muslim groups and things like that and do jihad. It's also the folks who are nice Christian folks at home who don't mind blowing up things because they're upset.
Can you conceive of a scenario in which some of our homegrown terrorists would stage something massive?
The Hutari. I was laughing because a couple of weeks ago we had a sort of a street festival here in Philadelphia, and there were a bunch of guys passing out CDs about the conspiracy at 9/11. And that was part of what they said, was that this was a homegrown thing and it wasn't about anybody else coming from some other country. And I thought, oh, wow, this is really something. So, I mean, if you fold all of this in with the, you know, Christian beliefs about the end times and everybody's beliefs about end times, I mean, no matter what religion you've got, I mean, this makes for a really volatile mix. And what I do think our governmental officials don't quite understand, Miranda rights or not, is that when people are motivated by, you know, sort of religious themes, and whether they think it's, you know, we need to bring in the kingdom of God or the kingdom of Allah or anything else, so our misunderstanding of these things and the inability to really suss some of these things out will cost us in the end. And I think this is part of the reason why we're having problems in the war on terror, is that, you know, half of the time we're looking for the wrong kinds of things and we're not interrogating the kinds of questions that need to be asked to drive people to these things.
Right. And isn't it the case that religiously the biggest default or misfeasance, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it, since the war on terror began, remains the fact that people, we don't have that very strong voice that looks at this globally and looks at it deeply ethically,
yeah.
and says, you know, why do they hate us? Well, here are perhaps some reasons. Here, you know, here are 500 military bases. Here are all these coups that we still engineer.
Yeah.
We need to move into that world house that King talked about. I know a handful of religious leaders with that perspective, but they're not out there in the public square. They're not saying that in a vocal, dramatic way.
Yeah.
This has to stop.
Yeah. And we don't have those kind of people who are willing to. I mean, when I try to tell people now, everything is 140 characters or a 600 to 1,000 word op-ed or blog piece. It's really hard to get at these deep ideas because nobody has the listening patience. We are all ADD where that's concerned, right? But there's also no sort of, and I don't want to say that we need this. It's almost saying like we need the fascist leader, right? But there's no sorts of moral authorities you can go to. I mean, if you think about, you can't ask people in the Catholic Church anymore to be your moral authority, right? They've got their own issues of their own, which we'll get to in a sec. I mean, you don't have the same, liberal Protestantism doesn't have the same kind of leadership.
Doesn't have the visibility or the...
If we believe Eddie Glaude, the black church is dead, so it doesn't matter anyway, right? I mean, I'm being facetious, but there is a dearth of this kind of voice. And it's what I've sort of been thinking about lately is that, you know, since there's no moral voice, does the media serve as a moral voice for us you know, albeit however faint it is it that moral voice now instead of, you know, what religion was supposed to serve?
It could be, but then again, your point about fragmentation obviously applies in the media. The difficulty is that what I would consider to be the high end media has greater intensity but an ever shrinking audience.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a real serious problem. I mean, not that Bill Moyers was the be-all, end-all, but a lot of people have said, wow, you know, that's the last person who could take that, you know, sort of encyclopedic view.
Yeah.
And evaluate the news within that deeper moral frame.
Yeah, exactly. There's no Walter Cronkite, right?
Right.
You know?
And all he did was read the news.
Exactly. But everybody trusted him, you know? Everybody trusted him.
Still, people felt that deep down he was a moral person.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. And he did say some moral things. I mean, it's like, you know, when he came back from Vietnam, right? You know, this is an unwinnable war. I mean, it's like, you know, Lyndon Johnson had to say himself, if I don't have Cronkite, I don't have anybody. So, I mean, even he's able to say something to, you know, the President of the United States. We don't have anybody like that now. You know, who's going to say anything to Obama? The only person that, you know, shoots back at Obama every now and again is Sarah Palin on our Twitter page. and that drives me crazy. But, I mean, you know, what's that, right?
Right. Well, Anthea, we're depressing ourselves. We should end this interview on a...
on a high note?
more joyful note, which is we learned this week that bishops in the Roman Catholic Church don't actually work for the Pope.
You know, I love that,
you
right?
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, they don't work for the Pope anymore. They're free agents. So, you know, I'm sure none of them knew that, right? Since they have to go to meetings that he calls and everything, and every time he calls a synod, they've got to show up in Rome. But yes, they are free to not have to listen to anything he has to say, which I think is a new low, you know, perhaps, in the ways in which the Church is trying to tap dance themselves out of these laws that are proposed in the state of New York and some other places to extend the statute of limitations. This is just craziness. I mean, the bottom line is this. Whether they're free agents or not, or self-employed individuals who probably haven't filed the Schedule C in years. The fact of the matter is that the Church is going to pay. And they can pay now, or they can pay later. And they're already paying later. And they're paying right now. I mean, there's no question about this. But, you know, the degree of silliness that is coming out now about this and the machinations of everybody running around with the, you know, I like to call it the rustling of the cassocks and the papers is ridiculous. And I don't know if they think they're going to stop the gray lady from looking at them or people like me from writing about, you know, this malfeasance and their absolute... churlishness about children. But, you know, being self-employed does not negate the fact that the Church has responsibilities, you know, towards those who have been abused. And I don't care how they try to get out of it. I don't care what kind of new thing they come up with. They're not bright enough. And they don't have enough money to hire the good lawyers anymore. That's just the bottom line.
I don't think they've got the best legal minds working for them on this one. I mean, I actually had my sister's an attorney, and I was thinking, and she has a limited liability corporation. I said, what do you think the prospects are? Holy Roman Catholic Church, LLC.
I don't think so. I mean, listen, I'll close with this. Here in Philadelphia, and I'm going to forget the name, so all the Philadelphians will be upset with me. What used to be the biggest Catholic school in the world is closing. It used to hold, at the height of its heyday, 6,000 students. The Catholic Church is an organization on the skids. And in the next 10 years, they're going to have more empty buildings, more empty churches, more empty schools, and they will not have the finances nor the insurability to keep up what's going on right now. And that is the truth. I don't care what they try to do right now. If they think about this from just a purely organizational perspective, they're toast. That's all it is. It's the truth. And so, it's the biggest problem they've got right now, and they will not face it. I mean, let aside the moral stuff and everything else. Like, they just want to be immoral, like BP. See, BP, you know, with the oil thing, they can pay out ad infinitum because they had profits. The Catholic Church has no profits to pay out from.
Once again, You don't have to be a Marxist to understand this. Economics is the driver.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, let's leave it there. This is a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to review the week's news with you.
Yeah.
Let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Take care.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.